I presume all of us here, or those who will be watching this session later, have had this feeling of you are ready to speak. And at least in my case, my hands begin to sweat and I feel some stomachache. I've been preaching for 20 years, but every time I do so for a smaller group or a bigger audience, there is a similar feeling. And I would say that even increases when I know that in that audience, there will be people who are not yet followers of Christ, who are non-Christians. What a privilege, isn't it? But what a challenge as well. And this afternoon, in these coming minutes that we have together, I have been asked to talk about a preaching with a missional aim. I have to say this is a passion and an area that I, like yourself, try to learn more and more as I combine my pastoral but also evangelistic ministry, and today serving through community Bible study, which I'll be happy to share more once we conclude, a ministry developing methods and studies of the Bible in over 100 countries in 80 languages. And recently I had the opportunity of doing a doctorate in the area of preaching and releasing a book in this topic. So I believe for those reasons I was asked to share some ideas with you this afternoon. Now, I know we should avoid always generalizations, but I think you might agree with me when I say that it's right to observe that preaching in church services across the world, including Europe, and I presume in your country as well, is mostly oriented to Christians when we think of our preaching at services. Generally, in many of our contexts, our weekly sermons do not communicate adequately with non-Christians who might be present in that gathering. And I would even say, hi, welcome. Many Christians in our fellowship sometimes do not feel stirred to invite unbelievers to hear the Sunday service sermon at our local congregations. And oftentimes when unbelievers attend the service, they often will probably hear a message that for some sounds foreign to them. Perhaps it's not your situation, but I believe, without wanting to generalize, this is very common in our church gatherings. And I would say that many hold the common view that preaching that takes place in church services on Sundays should be focused on the edification of Christians, whereas preaching to non-Christians should occur in, let's say, evangelistic initiatives or radio programs or social media initiatives geared toward non-Christians. And even most of our homiletical literature promote this view. On our church gatherings, we are primarily edifying Christians, and therefore our sermon will help accomplish that purpose. Whereas when we want to speak to non-Christians, we do so in other environments or in specific evangelistic services. Now, I would argue that the habit of preaching exclusively to Christians in Sunday services is seen in at least three ways. First, the way we prepare our sermons. Secondly, in the content we present, and also in the language that we tend to use. First, I think most of us preachers do not craft our Sunday sermons with non-Christians in mind, necessarily. Think for a moment that period of time, maybe minutes, hours, days, or weeks, when we are crafting our messages. And perhaps just few of us would consider questions such as, will unbelievers understand these affirmations? What sort of opposition would they raise to this truth that would require some apologetic argumentation? Or what cultural idols should I uncover and address when speak about this biblical truth? Or how should I introduce my topic so that I may capture everyone's attention, including those in the audience who have never heard a sermon or may not be even interested in the biblical teaching that I'm about to bring? Or What biblical or evangelical terminology or teachings will require translation or definition or contextualization in order for everyone in the room to grasp what I'm intending to communicate. So I believe that as Sunday preachers, mostly as pastors, we seem to be much more inclined to have our church members or followers of Christ in mind, determining the sort of message we present. I think also, secondly, that the content we present is generally geared at Christians only, and we tend to expect that our listeners will have a set of background, experience, biblical knowledge, frameworks that will therefore relate to the message that we are presenting. And I think it's also clear that our habit of thinking exclusively about Christians in our church gathering preaching is seen in the language that we often use. And as you know, and I know, most non-Christians in our European context do not know what Old Testament is or New Testament, what a prophet is or an apostle is. And sometimes, or oftentimes, we tend to use that sort of language that sounds foreign to those people who are not yet part of a faith community. I don't want, again, to be generalizing, but making a broad observation of our evangelical churches and how we relate to our Sunday sermons. However, I observe that when we think of our evangelistic or apologetic initiatives, this is quite different. We are thinking about the non-Christians. We are using a language that is relating to them. We are considering the questions that they might be asking. But this is not true in our Sunday or congregational sermons. And therefore, my friends, I think this highlights what I consider to be four divides or four dichotomies in our approach to Sunday preaching or congregational preaching if you meet on another day of the week. First, I would highlight a divide in the audience to whom we speak. The sermon. Oh, sorry, I forgot to mention this quote or even prayer by Zach Eswin. And he says, the prayer of many of us is that God would raise up a generation of expository evangelists, preachers who understand biblical exposition in missional terms, preachers whose hearts burst with love for sinners, preachers who no longer dismiss biblical exposition when they think of engaging culture, and preachers who no longer expound the Bible with disregard for the unchurched people around them. And this is indeed the part of the intentions we have with this conversation. And going back to the four divides that I'm observing, first of all, in our audience. And therefore, for many of us, the sermon is either aimed at Christians or aimed at non-Christians. And generally, our church preaching is aimed at Christians. Secondly, I think we could highlight a divide in our hermeneutics, our interpretation of the Bible. Or we could even say in the content we are presenting. It's very clear. Some think when we are presenting, preaching, communicating with non-Christians, we are preaching Christ. When we are preaching to Christians, we are actually preaching the Bible to them. It's then either preaching Christ or preaching the Bible. Thirdly, I think we can highlight a divide in the application of apologetics, which is often embraced by many of us. Perhaps in your own context, as I see in Spain and in other parts of Europe, there has been an increased interest in apologetics and the realization that we need to understand the questions that people are asking. And we are training and applying that in our evangelistic communication, apologetics as well, apologetical communication, sorry. But many, I don't think so, are applying those in our communication within the church community. And therefore, there seems to be this divide of the use of apologetics outside the Christian community. And finally, I think we can observe a divide in our contextualization. There is a set of language, terms, and presuppositions that we use in our Sunday sermons for Christians, and a very different one in our evangelistic talks or initiatives outside the church life or in specific events that we may develop. And therefore, it seems to be the case that it creates a cycle where our believers, our church people, do not feel stirred to invite non-Christians to hear that sermon or that preaching because it's not thought to be prepared for them. And even preachers ourselves do not have that in mind. In other words, it may be lacking a missional approach when we embrace our Sunday services. Now, my friends, in the next few minutes, I would like to invite us to consider eliminating each of these apparent divides. I would like to offer a four-part model of weekly preaching, the first being the inclusion of both Christians and non-Christians as our target audience. It's not either one or the other, it's both. Secondly, it is about preaching the Bible and Christ always, not one or the other. Thirdly, applying apologetics to our Sunday sermons, our church preaching. And finally, becoming intentional in our contextualization of our weekly messages so that unbelievers in Spain, in Poland, in England, in Switzerland, in the Czech Republic might become engaged, interested, and find that the message we are presenting on a weekly basis is relevant to them. And honestly, I see no reason why we would have to embrace so often these dichotomies when, as we will see in a minute, they do not necessarily find a biblical foundation. It has to do with our tradition, our way of doing things, which may be good in themselves, which we want to honor, but we need to always be reflecting whether they are indeed biblical. Now, these four parts are interconnected, but not dependent on each other, as we will explore in a minute. And allow me just to, are you still awake? I know it's, or feeling like a Spanish siesta at the moment. Let me just highlight, we are not talking about moving the pendulum to the other side and only speaking to non-Christians in our church gatherings. This is not what we are talking about. We are considering building four bridges so that we can speak to both audiences always, with therefore a missional approach being deep but relevant to both audiences on a weekly basis. So, briefly, allow me to camp in each of these four parts of this model of approaching our weekly sermons. First of all, let me invite you to consider expanding our audiences, and therefore we preach to both Christians and non-Christians. 1 Corinthians 14:23-25 is probably the earliest window to some aspects of the church gathering that is given in the Bible in terms of chronology. Okay? And there we find the Apostle Paul exhorting his readers, something that is quite striking. And Paul says, "So, if the whole church comes together and everyone speaks in tongues and inquires," the original Greek can be translated by idiotes, "or unbelievers' epistles come in. So if seekers or inquirers or unbelievers come in, will they not say that you are out of your mind? But if an unbeliever or an inquirer comes in while everyone is prophesying, they are convicted of sin and are brought under judgment by all, as the secrets of their hearts are laid bare. So they will fall down and worship God, exclaiming, God is really among you. Notice how impressive Paul is mentioning two groups of people, in addition to believers, that may be present at the church gathering: the inquirers and the unbelievers. And what is mainly of interest in our conversation this afternoon is the clear reference to unbeliever epistles attending the service. Now, the term is found 23 times in the New Testament in reference to those who were not Christians. And this passage reveals the fact that the early church did in fact expect the presence of non-believers in their gatherings. And Paul is revealing his concern that when they are communicating, non-believers should be understanding what is being communicated. They must be reached so that God may transform them and they may be able to worship God. But also, as we are giving biblical foundation to the invitation to speak to both Christians and non-Christians, allow me to remind you that it is vital to recognize that we do not have a prescriptive body of New Testament teachings regarding the liturgy of a church gathering. We have no biblical passage that tells us how we should go about a church service, how we should preach. And actually, there is no example of one sermon in a church gathering in the New Testament. We see Jesus preaching in the synagogue or outside. But after Jesus' death and resurrection, as the church is born, we see the apostles preaching outside church services, and there is no example of a church service sermon. Possibly, the book of Hebrews is a sermon that we have written there, and our only example of what a sermon looked like in the early church. So, if there is no prescription of how we must do it, can we therefore reconsider our audience and say, let us speak to both the Christians and non-Christians? And the church history also, this is very interesting, we don't have time to go into very deep examinations, show us that from the beginning, we were communicating with both audiences. Now, these are the first three recorded post-apostolic sermons in church history. After the Bible, these are the first three documents we have of sermons. Second Clement is the name of the sermon or the document, early second century. Peripascha, the second half of the second century, by Benito of Sardis. And finally, Quis Divers Salterio, late second or early third century, by Clement of Alexandria. What is very interesting about these three first sermons is the fact that in all of them, and I invite you to look them up on the internet and take a look, they are communicating with Christians, but also with non-Christians. There are parts of the sermons where they are preaching to Christians, and there are parts of the sermons where they are preaching to non-Christians. Secondly, allow me to invite you to consider expanding your hermeneutics, our biblical interpretation. Instead of thinking we preach Christ for non-Christians and we preach the Bible for Christians, we are reminded that we preach both, always. And we do so, I suggest, with a Christ-centered interpretation of scriptures. And allow me to highlight the definition of this type of hermeneutics. One before, please, Anna. Some biblical foundation, a little bit of the church history, and some application. We will need to run a bit, and there is much more we can talk about, but as we seek to respect our time, I'll try to be brief. Sidney Grenades, who with an influential author in the area of Christ-centered hermeneutics and preaching says, Christ-centered preaching means sermons that authentically integrate the message of the text with the climax of God's revelation in the person, work, and or teaching of Jesus Christ as revealed in the New Testament. For example, Luke 24, 27, Jesus says to his followers, "And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, Jesus explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." Shortly after, Jesus tells the 11 apostles and other disciples, "Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." And then he opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. I realize that not all of the Christian biblical scholars embrace Christ-centered hermeneutics. Particularly, I do think it is the way that we are invited by Christ and the apostles to read scriptures. Now, commenting on the on Christ-centered hermeneutics, Ed Stetzer writes the following: "We should respect the original author's intent, focusing on the passage at hand as it is, before broadening our views to see how the passage fits into the overarching story of God. It is important that we do both. We see that the original author is doing, and then we look to see how the Spirit more fully invests a passage with layers of application and significance in light of Christ's coming." Let me suggest, quoting Grenadus again, 7 practical steps of how we can apply Christ-centered hermeneutics, and therefore we come to the text and we preach the text through the lenses of Jesus, understanding that the embodied word and the written and oral word actually come to be one in Jesus Christ. And every time we proclaim scriptures, we are proclaiming Christ. Grenadus suggests 7 practical steps. First, the redemptive historical progression. That is, we understand that the Bible is a progressive revelation of God. And we take a text in the Old Testament and then we see how it's going to progress later on. For example, we understand this is the big biblical narrative of creation. There is God's redemptive acts in Israel that culminate in God's redemptive acts in Christ. And then, that's the part of history we find ourselves in, God's redemptive acts in church and world history until he establishes fully his new creation. So, if I'm preaching, let's say, from Samson, I'm invited to share what it meant for the first audience, but I understand that in many ways, Samson is also talking about Christ. And there are layers in the text that through Christ I can grasp now. The same way that Samson was a judge, his birth was announced, for example, and he was a sinful judge who was used in God's hand to liberate his people. I now know that Christ was a perfect judge who liberated his people. So there is an additional layer that as a follower of Christ, I can bring to this text once I understand what it meant for the first original audience. Why not bring this additional layer, understanding how it's going to be progressed? Secondly, Grenada suggests we do a promise fulfillment reading and understand how there are promises in the Old Testament that are fulfilled in Christ. Let me keep going quick. We can think of typology. And we know that so many characters in the Old Testament, Adam, Abel, Seth, Enoch, Noah, many are types of Christ in many ways. And therefore, I'm not only preaching about Noah, but I understand in which ways Noah is a type of Christ, as I'm also communicating an additional layer of meaning to this rich biblical text. He suggests this analogy, and we could think of many examples. For example, Psalm 23:1, David wrote, "The Lord is my shepherd." Later on, Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd." So I can preach from Psalm 23, understand what it meant for David and his initial people and audience. But through Christ, it gathers a new layer of meaning. Grenadas also suggests we consider longitudinal themes. It's a technical term in biblical theology referring to themes that can be traced throughout scriptures. For example, covenant or the temple or God's people. And therefore, we observe what's happening and are able to preach Christ from whatever passage we are preaching from. A New Testament references is a very obvious one. When Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus is actually quoting Psalm 22:1. So if I'm preaching from Psalm 22:1, I may want to connect it to what Christ has said later. And there are many references, as we know, in the New Testament. Finally, he speaks of contrast. For example, I may preach from Psalm 24 or 95, where the psalmist says, "God, do not cast me out of your presence." Now, there is a contrast, because I'm a follower of Jesus, and the Spirit of God now lives in me, and he has promised not to leave me, so I should not be praying that he would not leave me. His presence will not leave me. I live in a different period of history than the psalmist. There is an original message there, but there is a new layer of meaning because of what Christ has done and his Spirit is now in me. Are you with me as we consider how we preach both the Bible and Christ? Thirdly, I would like us to build this bridge and consider applying apologetics in our weekly church sermons. I like the metaphor of apologetics being the exercise of removing the rocks of us, the soil where we want to plant the seeds of the gospel. Doing apologetics, in a way, is considering which are the rocks in the minds, the hearts of the young people I want to reach, the older people I want to reach, the people that are here. So I'm going to deal with those rocks as I plant the seed. And sometimes we forget that many followers of Christ have their rocks in their minds and hearts. And we need apologetics for non-Christians, and we need apologetics for Christians. Because also we are helping them on Monday morning, Tuesday afternoon, when they are at the gym or university or that coffee shop, to help those non-Christian friends understand the Christian faith and remove the rocks. Why not regain the understanding that the faith community is an apologetic community by nature? John Guest, who has served as both pastor and evangelist, makes a strong case for the recovery of apologetics in church life, particularly in preaching. And let me read a quote from him. He says, "The church must never forsake her high, urgent calling to engage in apologetics. Whatever the role of parachurch organizations, and God has blessed them with great fruit, a full-orbed witness requires a gathering of believers, for only in the church can all of God's designs for believers find fruition." And he continues and says, "And it is in the experience of worship that the relational and rational aspects of the Christian meet. There, the unbelieving choir sees what faith looks like up close and lived out. Congregational life provides the habitat for faith and the heartbeat to our work of giving a reason for the hope that we have." We could make a case and see that several biblical documents, books of the Bible, are apologetics in its own nature. For example, narrative of creation in Genesis 1 is the presentation of a narrative, but it's also in contrast with all the narratives that were operating in those times. So the apologetics in the communication of the truth is something that we see throughout the scriptures. And it's helpful, I would like to highlight, for the non-Christians, but also for the Christians. So why not consider applying that to our weekly sermons? And consider the rocks that people have in their hearts and minds as I'm preparing my sermons and as I am communicating them as well. Peter J. Grant writes, "From what we know of the early church, it is abundantly clear that apologetics was at the heart of their ministry as witness. The New Testament church leaders went about their mission as they argued with, discussed with, persuaded, and convinced their hearers, whether in the synagogue or in the marketplace." Finally, let me invite you to consider building another bridge, the contextualization. What do we mean by contextualization? At a basic level, it is the process of placing something into context. It's the adaptation to a certain culture. And contextualization of speeches is seen throughout the pages of the Bible. When Anne and I were leaving the UK, we had some months finishing my master's degree in, I studied at the London School of Theology, but I was finishing my research in Aberdeen. It was a difficult time. We found out that I had a cancer and I had an operation and a chemotherapy. By God's providence and grace, it was limited. So I had the time to study. And the focus of my 4 month studies as I was finishing my dissertation was on Paul's evangelistic sermons in the book of Acts. And something that struck me, and I still, like yourself, like you all, learn from his speeches in the book of Acts, is how he contextualized his sermon depending where he was preaching the same gospel. Acts 13, he's preaching in a synagogue. Acts 14, he's preaching outside to non-Jews who didn't have much studies. Acts 17, he's preaching in Athens, intellectual non-Jews. And it's striking to compare and see that he's speaking in a very different way. And that contextualization is not an option. The mission of God is in its essence a contextualized mission. I would dare to say that not contextualizing is going against the movement of God from the beginning as he seeks to dress his words and himself in manners that people will relate to. Jesus Christ being the embodiment of contextualization when God becomes a human being. Therefore, what would happen if we try to use a language, a manner of communicating, a way of arguing that would relate to both the Christians but also the non-Christians? And I think Graham Johnston is right to affirm that biblical communication to a postmodern culture should be approached in the same way that a missionary goes into a foreign culture. So allow me to share some practical recommendations for sermon contextualization. And we don't have the time to expand on them, but at least allow me to mention these. First of all, let's consider using accessible or well-explained vocabulary. I think preachers should not abandon the use of biblical terms. There are terms that are biblical and we don't find synonyms in our different languages. For example, sin. It's not only a mistake. It's not only it's a biblical word that I believe we need to use. However, they need to be translated and given synonyms whenever possible. For example, instead of saying only the Gospel of John, think about your friends who are non-Christians or even Christians. What is the Gospel of John for them? I dare to say that most people in Europe do not know what the Gospel is. Well, perhaps, instead of only saying the Gospel of John, I could describe it as the biography of Jesus according to John. or the accounts of the life and the work of Jesus described by a good friend and biographer called John. That is a way of describing it, and I don't have to repeat it 10 times during my sermon. I would use it once, and therefore, that girl, that guy, that man that is visiting or listening for the first time, and by the way, many now are listening later through YouTube or podcasts, and this is encouraging our Christian people to let their non-Christian not only invite them into our services and meetings or gatherings, however you call it in our tradition, but then share those messages with their non-Christian friends. And I'm translating, I'm giving a synonym, and later on the same message, I can refer to the Gospel of John. And now people know what I'm talking about because I have translated. For example, if I say the psalmist, do we know what a psalmist is? Yeah, but many people in our congregations do not know what a psalmist is. So I want you to know that although I'm saying psalmist, I care so much about you that I want to be clear. I want to make sure that I'm taking your hand. I'm going to go deep with you here in this message, but I'm not letting you go. So I care about you, and I want you to know that a psalmist is the same as a singer, a poet, a composer. We call them psalmist. Oh, I hope that you are with me and that I have explained to you this biblical, and I'll later say the psalmist, but now you know what I mean by this poet or songwriter. When I say the New Testament, half of our congregation do not know. But if I say to you the New Covenant, that is the second part of the Bible, the what happens after the life of Christ, that is the New Testament, then I can later say the New Testament and you are there with me. So these are just examples of the prophets. As the prophet, what is a prophet? What comes to people's mind when we think of prophet? Well, a person who talks from God to other people. That's what we call a prophet. Now, the prophets are, and you are there with me. Secondly, I would suggest we consider giving additional layers of background and context as we seek to preach to both Christians and non-Christians. Let me show you the Engel scale. I don't know if you are familiar with it, but a professor in the U.S. many decades ago called Engel made an observation that I find very helpful and suggested that people go through a spectrum, a journey in their spiritual life, and that some of us think that people are in the minus one and they will cross the line and know Jesus and then they go to the other side. And Engel helped many to be reminded that actually there are people in the minus two, minus three, minus four, minus five, or minus 10. And in our European cultures, we have many people further back. And often when we speak like we tend to speak in our church gatherings, we are touching people in the minus one, minus two, or plus one, plus two, plus three, when most of our populations are actually further back. To contextualize is to be invited to love those who are further back and say, our sermons will touch the people in the plus three who are becoming mature Christians, but I'm interested in also communicating with those who are not interested, who are thinking, for example, in the existence of many gods or are atheists, and therefore I'm starting further back. There was another author who suggested another type of scale, which is similar and a development from Engel's scale, and he's more interested in how people are feeling and experiencing in a postmodern context this journey. And again, we don't have time to go into details, but what I wanted to highlight from this is our consideration as preachers that we need to realize in many of our European contexts, people are further back, and therefore we want to communicate and translate terms and give background in such a way that they will understand better what we are saying. Because if I affirm, as you know, Moses was... No, people don't know what Moses, who Moses was and what Moses did. And I don't want you to feel that you are left out when I say so. So Moses, an important leader in the biblical narrative, a man God used to liberate his people from a place called Egypt to... Okay, I've given you 20 seconds to give you some additional background, and you are learning, you are there with me, and I'm helping our Christian people to know how to do the same on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, when they talk to their friends. And therefore, our communication is embracing more people and therefore reaching the non-Christians and the Christians as well. Thirdly, let me suggest we consider introductions to our preaching that engages with the whole audience. What sort of examples of feelings, of references to our culture can I begin with so that from the start of my sermon, I can connect with John, who is a committed Christian, but I can connect it with Mary, who is only seeking. And easily, I, as a Christian preacher, can begin where Christians are. I find it quite striking to consider how Paul, in Acts 17, goes about his sermon. It is true, he is not preaching a church gathering, but he is speaking in Athens, a polytheistic context. I do think that very often we preach like Paul did in Acts 13 in a synagogue to an European context that looks like much more Athens of Acts 17. We I believe, need to recover much more the approach of Paul in Acts 17 as he went about a society that had no biblical framework. And you will remember that he walks... Luke tells us, and he uses certain a group of Greek verbs in the beginning of the description of Paul in Athens to show that Paul was dialoguing, Paul was talking, Paul was listening every day, and he was walking around. Before speaking, he was listening. He knew the answers, but he wanted to know the questions. And later on, he's able to quote several Greek poets. He knew the culture, he knew the songs, he knew the Netflix series they were watching, he knew what they were talking about. And when he is then invited to preach in the Areopagus, he begins by saying, "You are sinners, you are worshiping a..." No, I was walking around and I have noticed that you have an altar to an unknown God. The unknown God that you basically don't know about is the God I want to share with you. I want to tell you about. So Paul is beginning where people are, and he ends his sermon in Acts 17 in Jesus Christ. But notice how he begins where people are, and I think the introduction needs to help us engage people where they are, and from there we will build our bridges. Fourth place, allow me to suggest we openly acknowledge those in the audience who may not be Christians. At least in my context, every time I'm preaching on a church gathering, I appreciate saying something like, "It's great to be with you. Welcome, everyone. Perhaps you are here and you don't agree with what we are singing, or you don't even believe in the existence of God. It is great to be together. Thank you for being here." And later on my sermon, I may say, "If you're a follower of Christ, this is going to be a challenge for you. But maybe you are here and you are not a follower of Christ. You may be even questioning what I'm saying." And that is fantastic. By the way, I would love to talk to you once we finish this meeting. So you are acknowledging the presence, the perceptions, the questions of people who don't agree with you. That is affirming. That is creating a culture that is missional. And let us be reminded that language creates culture. So as preachers, we have that power of helping to create the culture in our communities as we affirm, speak, embrace, welcome those who are not Christians as well. It is not only to the no, it is to both, again I say. So if you are a Christian, this is. But if you are not one, then... Or if this is what you may be asking yourself at the moment, if this is now in your... So you see, I'm dialoguing. I am inviting and I'm acknowledging their presence. And hopefully, that creates a culture of people saying, I want to invite my friends to listen to this guy or to this woman, because they are speaking to me, but they are speaking to my friends. Or on Monday, I want to share this podcast or this YouTube talk to my friends because they are communicating with me and with them. And again, I say, it's not only with non-Christians. It is about being deep, not being light. It's about being deep in our biblical communication. But we take people by their hands and we do not let them go because we translate the terms. We begin where they are. We communicate. We deal with the rocks in their hearts. We are translating the terms so we can indeed go deep. But we will always take them to Christ as we preach both the Bible and Christ, not letting them go. Fifth place, allow me to suggest at least sometimes we communicate biblical authority inductively. Donald Sunukian, he was my tutor in the doctorate at Talbot School of Theology, wrote, while it's accurate to say something is true because it is in the Bible, it is even more accurate to say something is in the Bible because it is true. Did you follow that? Allow me to repeat. Something is true because it's in the Bible. And we may say, the Bible says, and it's true, but many in our context, like Paul in Acts 17, the Bible says doesn't mean anything to them because there is no framework of biblical authority. Paul in Acts 17 never quotes the Bible. Now, his whole content is built on the Bible, but he quotes Greek poets more than once. Do you know that beautiful verse that says, in him we live and exist and have our beings? Well, that's a quotation from a Greek poet who wrote that about Zeus, the Greek god. And Paul says, well, actually, this is true, but it's not true for Zeus. It's true for the god that I'm announcing to you, the unknown god. So Paul, all the time in his sermon in the Areopagus, is connecting and confronting. Connecting and confronting. Identifying truth in culture, redeeming it, but reorienting it to the true God. What a beautiful way also to communicate biblical authority inductively, helping a postmodern culture that is looking for things that work and showing them it is working, it's real, and therefore it is in the Bible. And we may start with people's experience and demonstrating that the Word of God is therefore presenting that truth as God continues to build their framework. And as people then will, by God's help, acknowledge that the Bible is indeed the Word of God. Finally, allow me to suggest we also use influential cultural authorities to strengthen and illustrate key points. Who are the people listening to? Who are the artists, the singers, the TikTok influencers, the celebrities, the writers, the poets that are authorities in a certain culture? It is a beautiful and important exercise to build those bridges as we seek to preach to Christians and non-Christians, showing Christians that what the Word of God says is related to our daily lives, but showing non-Christians as well that there is truth in culture and that we may relate that to what God is saying. That is what Paul is again doing in Acts 17. He quotes Greek poets because they were authorities to that culture. But he confronts them at the same time saying, this is not about Zeus. This is about the God I am proclaiming to you. There is a well-known Spanish singer, some of us will know, called Alejandro Sanz. He's an extremely popular songwriter and singer, one I really enjoy listening to. There is a song by Alejandro Sanz, which actually I quote in the beginning of my chapter on contextualization on the book, where he sings something like, I won't sing to you, don't worry, but he sings something like, a la primera persona que me ayude a comprender. To the first person that helps me to understand. To the first person that helps me to feel. To the first person to help that takes me out of this hell. I want to give this person my time, my faith, etc., etc. Alejandro Sanz is singing a very, very popular song demonstrating the human cry for someone to save him. Now, in the song, he's looking for a woman that will bring that to him. What if I connected that cry of a cultural celebrity and admired man and say, oh, I am like him. There is a cry inside. You are like him. This is very human. However, no woman, no man is going to satisfy that. Only Jesus Christ is going to satisfy that sort of hunger that Alejandro Sanz or myself have. So in a way, just a simple example of how we can bring a reference of a cultural celebrity, authority in a topic and relate to both Christians and non-Christians. I know there are much more elements we can think about, but allow me to just summarize and invite us to consider that there is clearly at least four divides in our evangelical tradition of church preaching. That is, preaching to either Christians or non-Christians, preaching the Bible or Christ, using apologetics outside church life but not within our church speech, and contextualizing a way outside but not in our Sunday gatherings or services. I've tried to suggest that this is not necessarily biblical. It's a tradition that we have built, and that the Bible gives us a lot of flexibility on how we go about making disciples of Jesus. Therefore, I'm not suggesting this is the right way, but it is a possible way. And therefore, we consider building four bridges and we preach to both Christians and non-Christians every time we do so. We preach Christ and the Bible every time through a Christ-centered hermeneutics. We build another bridge and we apply apologetics to our church life, particularly to our preaching. Considering dealing with removing the rocks of people's minds and hearts. And finally, we build a last bridge and we seek to contextualize our Sunday congregational sermons through various ways that will help us approach preaching from a missional perspective.